It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. Today's show is a follow-up to a show that aired in February about Chugach State Park. I was intrigued by a few paragraphs in the 2016 management plan about the first people to arrive in the Anchorage area. I wanted to learn more about the seafaring first people who first discovered the Upper Cook Inlet and the Dena'ina Athabascans who then moved into the area we now know as Anchorage and hunted and fished in the area we now know as Chugach State Park. Although Aklutna Inc. owns 10% of the land that Chugach State Park sits on and is the largest private landowner in the Anchorage municipality, the Dena'ina have been called the Invisible People because the stories of their ancestors have not been heard. Aaron Leggett, Senior Curator of Alaska History and Indigenous Culture at the Anchorage Museum and President of the Tribal Council of the Native Village of Aklutna, joins me today to talk about the past, present, and future of the Dena'ina in the Anchorage area. Keep listening for more on Outdoor Explorer. My guest today is Aaron Leggett, Senior Curator of Alaska History and Indigenous Culture at the Anchorage Museum. He is Dena'ina Athabascan and is the President of the Tribal Council of the Native Village of Aklutna. Thanks for joining me today, Aaron.
Thank you for having me on, Lisa.
So in February of this year, and we're in 2021 right now, I did a show on Chugach State Park and particularly about the management plan that was updated in 2016. And there was just this very small portion of the plan that explained who had been in the area of the park originally. And I was very intrigued and wanted to know more. So that's why I reached out to you. And I'm so glad that you're here to talk about the first people in what is now Chugach State Park. So thank you again for joining me.
You're welcome. So my people are the Upper Cook Inlet Dena'ina Athabascan, or more specifically called the Kenechtana, the Kinnick River people. And basically our geographic home is what we now today consider all of the municipality of Anchorage, and then up into parts of the Mat-Su around Wasilla and the Little Sioux, and then going up towards on the old Glen Highway towards Jim Creek and all the way up to about the Butte area. So that kind of what we typically think of as sort of this area, you know, Anchorage and Anchorage proper, I suppose, or the bedroom communities. And then going south as far as about Indian would have been sort of the southern boundaries, just because of the geographic challenges, which we can talk about a little bit later. But the Dena'ina are one of 11 Athabascan or Dene-speaking people and in Alaska. They're also Dene-speaking or Athabascan-speaking people in Canada. And linguistically, Dene people are related to the Navajo and the Apache in the Southwest. So we're all one people, one language family over a massive geographic area. But the thing that distinguishes the Dena'ina are that we're the only northern Athabascans who live on saltwater or a marine environment, as well as sort of typical when most people think of Athabascans or Dene, it's sort of typical kind of hunter, fisher, trappers of the boreal forest. We check all those boxes, but we also had access to the ocean. And the Dena'ina don't claim that we've been here since time immemorial. Probably came in several migrations over the last 1,000 to 1,500 years. But so for a very long time. So it wasn't a recent migration. Some older, outdated signages, you know, sort of wants to attribute the fact that we had been here maybe no more than a few generations before the Russians arrived. But that's wrong. That was based on one archaeological test in the 1960s and is in a way to me highly offensive, because we can prove now at a minimum 800-900 years, and with better archaeology and knowing how to look in this area. Anyways, so we utilized, you know, the you know, our area, anybody that's lived here or lived here long enough will know that this is one of the most bountiful, you know, places in Alaska. It's, I like to say, it's no surprise that half the entire state's population lives in our traditional homeland. We kind of fit what I would argue is that Goldilocks, not too warm, not too cold kind of zone. And it's interesting, if you look around the circumpolar north, that 59 to 61, 62 degree latitude is a kind of a sweet spot. The, you know, the capitals of Scandinavia, you know, Norway, Sweden, and then Finland, which is not Scandinavian, Nordic, but nevertheless, Helsinki, St. Petersburg, are all within that kind of niche area. And so with that, also the abundant fish and wildlife, or at least historically used to be the fish, you know, the Kenai River with its giant runs of king salmon, and still, you know, the Kenai River and the Russian River for sockeye salmon, sockeye salmon, the silver salmon, that used to run into Upper Cook Inlet, into the Big Sioux, the Little Sioux, the Aklutna River. And then the land animals, bears, moose. Most people are surprised to know that at least until maybe the beginning of the 20th century or the later half of the 19th century, that actually caribou were the predominant big game animal, at least in this area, in and around Anchorage and into the Mat-Su Valley.
There's caribou down on the Kenai, right?
Those are transplanted.
Okay.
They were wiped out of and they were on the Kenai too. Mm-hmm. But the difference is that the caribou that were here were what are called the woodland caribou. They're a bigger species of caribou. And they've actually disappeared out of almost all of their historic range. There's a tiny pocket of them now in southern British Columbia, but they lived in the forests. They were they weren't like a herd, you know, animal. They didn't migrate in herds, or large herds, I should say. So they're more like elk, I guess, in the sense of their behaviors. And they would go up, you know, into the mountains. And it's said that, you know, parts of Chugach State Park were actually quite productive for that. So nobody's entirely sure why. I think it's a combination of probably over-harvesting, environmental changes, both, man-made, massive fires that swept through, like especially on the Kenai Peninsula and other areas. And probably just more general climate change that mm-hmm. would not have necessarily been precipitated at that time by as much. We would, or I'm sure human impact had something to do with a little bit of it, but, you know, what the Industrial Revolution did to the environment versus what we're doing today are not exactly the same worldwide. So, mm-hmm. And certainly in Alaska, you know, it wasn't the case. So, and so we did all those things, and then we also traveled on the waterways of Cook Inlet using technologies borrowed from our neighbors, the Aleutic or Sukbiak, like kayaks and large skin boats and that kind of thing.
I think there's two things here. I had no idea that there were caribou here. That is like something that is completely new to me. So thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was looking at something yesterday about Aleutic boats here, and I had no idea that there was that connection either.
Yeah.
So can we talk a little bit about more like who was here before the Athabascans were here?
Sure.
Because we think that there've been people here for about 10,000 years, right?
I think it's like five or six thousand. I think 10,000 years ago, this area was pretty much socked in with glaciers. You know, I mean, the Anchorage Bowl was all filled in, and so I think it's in the last 5 or 6,000 years, and as the glaciers started to recede. What I understand, so archaeologists like to categorize things into different sort of phases based on, you know, the tool assemblages and different things. And so there were several waves in Cook Inlet. So you have what's called an Ocean Bay culture, a prehistoric way, way back, which has similarities to Kodiak and parts of Prince William Sound. And then there's what's called the Kachemak Bay tradition, which centered, surprisingly, not surprisingly, in Kachemak Bay itself, and are probably the direct ancestors to Aleutic people. So in other words, what happened is at some point in the last 2,000 years pre other developments, the environment changed, and the life ways of the people that were living here were not as adapted to those changes, and they moved out and went to the Alaska Peninsula, Kodiak, Prince William Sound. And then there was also another group called what's been described as Riverine Kachemak. And this is a bit controversial, but I tend to believe this, that they may have been what we today consider the ancestors of modern day Yupik people. It should be pointed out that Yupik people and Aleutic or Sukbiak people genetically and linguistically are closely related but have very different lifestyles. So, you know, an outdated archaic term for the Aleutic or Sukbiak people was sometimes called Pacific Eskimo, and it was a more ocean-based lifestyle that borrowed also heavily or adapted, I should say. I don't want to use borrowed. We'll use the word adapted from the lifestyle further out on the Aleutian chain, their styles of boats and hunting. And so that's how when the Russians came in, it became deeply confusing to them, because they looked at the people they encountered out on the Aleutian chain all the way up into the Alaska Peninsula and Kodiak and Prince William Sound as one people. But we know linguistically and they are different people. Now, anciently, go back way, way, way back, they may have all been part of one group. But again, these things are all in flux, and so I don't want to ascribe too much. You know,
I was sort of surprised in the plan, which was finalized in 2016, that the term Eskimo was used generally. So, I mean, you've kind of fleshed out what that really should be. It should be an acknowledgement that there were different types of people that had a seafaring life.
Right.
And we shouldn't be lumping them all into that generalized term anymore.
Correct. Yeah. Well, so, yeah, I mean, the easy thing is that it's, you know, it's like Alaska has Eskimos, Indians, and Aleuts, basically. And then we all kind of diverge from that. But that's a pretty outdated term. But there has yet to be a better term invented. And so for the cursory overview, I see why they would use that, although it is falling out of favor, certainly.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about how the land in Alaska is for Indigenous people and how it's different than the land in the lower 48. We have a lot of listeners from around the world, and they might just subscribe to the United States, this reservation system.
Right.
And we don't have a reservation system, although we have one reservation, right? Metlakatla.
Correct.
And so I also want to talk a little bit about why we just have that one. That their decision, I'd really like to talk about ANCSA.
Okay. So from 1741 with the discovery, you know, by the Russians, so to speak, of Alaska. Of course, we were here. Until 1867, Alaska was under the, the Empire of Russia, the Tsarist Empire. And in 1867, Russia sold its interests in Alaska to the United States. There was a big concern that if the Russians didn't sell to the Americans, that the British would gobble it up and that we'd all become part of Canada. And of course, they had just gotten through a costly war, the Crimean War, where they were facing off against the British and others. And so the United States was looked at as the most favorable country to sell to. But what they sold for $7.2 million was Russia's interests in Alaska. So the forts that were established, say, at Unalaska, St. Michael, the Pribilof Islands being the key one, Kodiak, Kenai, Prince William Sound, and then their headquarters at Sitka. So the buildings and, you know, the forts and those things. And really what it was about at that time was more the trading rights and the, you know, sort of international standings. And so the Pribilof Islands in particular were really what cemented the deal, because on the Pribilofs from from about the beginning of the 19th century till 1986, I think, there was a commercial harvest of fur seals. 90% of the world's fur seals breed on the Pribilofs and still do. But there was a commercial harvest, and it's said that this was an incredibly lucrative endeavor. I've heard figures that within 2 years of harvesting fur seals off the Pribilofs, the United States made its money back. Whoa. That $7.2 million.
Wow.
So it's also important to remember that in 1867, we're 2 years out of the Civil War. We're in the middle of Reconstruction. Alaska kind of purchases, you know, or the U.S. purchases Alaska, but they really don't know what to do with it. There's some maps. The maps along the coast are pretty good, but the Russians never really got up into, you know, much of the interior of Alaska, up into the Copper River. Nobody knows where the border is. So all these things have to be worked out. And so for a number of decades, there's a lot of back and forth. But the thing that really kind of kicks it into high gear and makes it a priority for the United States to figure out, okay, what is it exactly that we have, comes with the number of gold rushes, in particular the Klondike gold rush, and where's the borders and who's in control of what, and creating some sort of central government, because from 1867 up through the 1890s, Alaska's governmental affairs were handled by the Department of the Army, and then it was the District of Alaska, then it became the Territory of Alaska. There's a whole series of different things. But in that were some vague references to what rights do Alaska Natives have, if at all any. And so in the Treaty of Session, there's, I think it's the third article, says that the quote-unquote civilized tribes of Alaska, so when they mean civilized, what they're talking about are the ones that had the most contact with Russians. So again, the people along the Aleutian chain, parts of the Alaska Peninsula, Kodiak, Kenai, Prince William Sound, basically said, depending on their natural allegiance, had the option to go to Russia to become Russian citizens. Now, it should be pointed out that in those areas, there was a lot of Russian men who had taken native wives and had children, and at that point some even grandchildren. Some had been educated in Russia, you know, sort of a Creole population, some of whom had essentially what we would consider to be college degrees at various naval schools and different academies in Russia, and could return within a number of years. And of course, the Russians that were here also had the option to return. But after a number of years, then that window closed. And again, under the Department of the Army, what they found was that, you know, a lot of the people that were in the Army were either ex-Confederate soldiers or had come off of the Indian Wars in the West, in California, the Modoc War, and others. And so they took a pretty dim view to the indigenous populations and really had no rights. So then after that, there is, I think in 1884, what's called the Organic Act, which is the first time that people could actually buy land in Alaska. And there's some brief mentions of what native rights are, but the point being, it was largely ignored. Later on, there was an allotment act, an Indian Allotment Act that was created, but not well understood or publicized. But to answer your question more specifically, by the 1880s, the federal government had said, had made a policy that they're not going to negotiate any more treaties, i.e. create more reservations. Now, the one reservation that we have in Alaska that you mentioned earlier, Metlakatla, the people of Metlakatla were actually Canadian, what today we would consider Canadian Tsimshian, that were leaving Canada under religious persecution from the because they were part of the Anglican Church, and under their priest, Father Duncan, had moved to Metlakatla, and through largely through his help, negotiated this one treaty. And what he was trying to do in Metlakatla was kind of create this model Indian community, kind of this experiment of how you could integrate indigenous people into the Western world, so to speak. So it meant, you know, largely abandoning most cultural customs and things like that. It didn't completely work. And certainly culture, you know, continues on Metlakatla and totem poles and a lot of that, but it had a very severe impact for a number of generations. Mm-hmm. So the question about who owns land in Alaska was largely unresolved. And that continued through the first half of the 20th century. But then after World War II, when there was finally enough of a population base in Alaska, non-native population base, I should say, to justify perhaps Alaska could become, instead of just a territory, but become a state on its own, there was the strategic defense of Alaska and the importance of that. So Alaska.
Okay, so just to be clear, I want to make sure I'm clear on this. So they were only counting the white population in Alaska to move it to territory status. They were not counting indigenous population.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't know. They
just didn't have a feeling for how many people were actually correct. Here.
Okay. Yeah, and then also, you know, several waves of different diseases, smallpox, the 1918 flu epidemic, other things, you know, wiped out large numbers of indigenous populations. So
I did see that. And one of the things I was reading about Anchorage was that there was a smallpox that wiped out a lot of people in the late 1800s, I think.
Early to mid 1836 to 1839. Okay. So, but I think it's not until 1920 that the you know, indigenous population becomes smaller than the non-native population of Alaska. So that's kind of the turning point. So, and that's kind of when sort of more of the modern industrialization happens. Anchorage starts to grow. You know, things kind of development sort of happens enough because there was a concern, and they'd seen it in other places where, you know, there would be a boom for a number of years, and then it would become either a ghost town or you know, become greatly reduced. I mean, if you see pictures of Nome at the beginning of the 20th century, you'd be surprised, you know, the number of people that were there. I've seen pictures of people that had, you know, grass tennis courts and on all these things. And so, but it wasn't sustainable. So I think it was the stability, and World War II kind of created that stability. And it also, I think, with the establishment of the military bases, was enough of a justification to start lobbying for statehood. And so ultimately in 1955, there was a constitutional convention where the delegates drafted a constitution. And then finally in 1959, Alaska became a state. So in 1959, when Alaska became a state for the first time, this state entity starts selecting lands that in areas that indigenous people had always considered to be, you know, their lands. And there were a number of also federal projects that were being proposed that would have drastically altered what we think of Alaska today. Fortunately, they didn't go through. The two biggest ones were, one was called the Rampart Dam, where it would have basically put a dam on the middle of the Yukon River and would have flooded 10 interior villages and created, at the time, the world's largest man-made lake, and would have been the largest hydroelectric project in the world, I think. I'd have to double check on that, but I'm pretty sure. And another one was a project called Project Chariot, where after World War II, there was the government was trying to figure out peaceful applications for atomic weapons. And so there was a proposal to detonate 7 nuclear bombs 20 miles from the village of Point Hope up on the northwestern coast of Alaska, up way up there, and would have created the world's large, or would have created the furthest north ice-free port in America. And they would have said, and they said basically that this would have no effect on the village 20 miles away. This is also at the beginning of the environmental movement and really kind of coming to terms with, you know, what is our impact on the environment and all these things. So various Alaska Native entities started forming to lobby for land claims. And also around that time, there was a newspaper created called the Tundra Times. It was started in Fairbanks that dealt specifically with Native issues. And this newspaper was you know, disseminated around the state. And for the first time, it was kind of like a light bulb went off when the Inupiat of Utqiagvik realized that they were basically having the same issues and fights that the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida's were having in Southeast about land claims and hunting seasons and subsistence and all these things. And so eventually in 1966, there was a convening of what became the Alaska Federation of Natives. And this first convention was largely funded by the Dena'ina from across the inlet over at Tionic, who at that time, like a Klutna, had an educational reserve that was set aside. And there was oil exploration that was wanting to occur on the reservation. And the normal way of it would have been the oil companies would have paid the federal government. The federal government through the BIA would have then disseminated those funds back to the village. Luckily, the villagers had befriended a lawyer in Anchorage, a man by the name of Stan McCutcheon, who was also involved with the Constitutional Convention and who came from a well-connected family in Alaska. His father had served in the territorial legislature, and he'd served in the territorial legislature as well, and sued the federal government to say, instead of the BIA getting the funds, the Native Village of Tionic should get the funds. They know what they need to do, and ultimately were successful. And part of that also led to the Secretary of the Interior at the time, Stuart Udall, putting a land freeze on the state of Alaska, saying that no more land will be selected by the state until native land claims are resolved. So this kind of goes for a couple of years. And of course, the state of Alaska is not happy about that. And it really becomes an issue in 1968 when oil is discovered at Prudhoe Bay. And the oil companies then are saying, after looking at some options of how to get the oil out, the most logical or the scenario that made the most sense was to create the Trans-Alaska pipeline. But the oil companies said, we're not building a pipeline over lands that we don't know who has the ownership to. And so all of a sudden, the people lobbying for land claims now have an ally on their side with the oil companies, their lawyers, their lobbyists, all those things. And it was a window in time. There was kind of a reevaluation of what is the federal government's, responsibility to natives. And it was largely looked at as the reservation system had been a failure for 95% of, the reservations. There might've been a couple that were, had a modicum of success, but they were few and far between. And so this all predates sort of Indian gaming and other economic development activities. And I would argue today, many of the reservations still face those same issues. So the point being that, in the 1960s, what did the reservation for the Mashituckit Pequot look like? You wouldn't know there was a reservation there. Now they're multi-billion dollar tribe. But at the same time, if you went to the Pine Ridge Reservation in 1965 and you went to the Pine Ridge Reservation today, it largely doesn't look different. So, so there was this effort to try something different. And what ultimately came out of that was the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And so as designed through, many years of back and forth, Alaska Natives retained 44 million acres of land and were compensated for just under $1 billion for lands that they weren't able to recover, to be divided between 12 regional corporations and 180, 190 or so smaller village corporations. And so any Alaska Native with at least one quarter blood born on or before December 18th, 1971, could enroll in one of these regional corporations, and if they chose, a village corporation as well.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. We are going to take a short break, and when we return, the conversation with Aaron Leggett will continue.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. My conversation with Senior Curator of Alaska History and Indigenous Culture at the Anchorage Museum and President of the Tribal Council of the Native Village of Aklutna, Aaron Leggett, continues.
So my village corporation is Aklutna Inc., and we'll get to that in a minute here. So ANCSA passes, and within a few, there's a lot of years are spent, most of the 70s are spent trying to figure out how do Alaska Native corporations make money? A lot of mistakes are made, lawsuits back and forth. What does this really mean? So forth, yada, yada, so on and so forth. Now in ANCSA, the only mandate that exists for the corporations is to make money for their shareholders. And of course, these shares are owned by the shareholders, but they're not on the open market, so to speak. And so the question is, how do tribes fit into this? And you have some corporations create and spin off social service entities, or take the old native associations that lobbied for land claims, and they become kind of the designated ones to provide social services. But what's discovered after a number of years is that the issues are too large for any one of the corporations to support on their own. And so what is the federal government's kind of trust responsibility? And so that's where tribes become part of the conversation. And it's realized that tribes, the question is, did ANCSA extinguish sovereignty? And after a number of years, it's discovered, no, it did not extinguish sovereignty. And in some ways, Alaska Native tribes are to be treated like tribes in the lower 48, because we never signed an official treaty that would have, established or taken that away. And so the tribes are able to access various federal grants and programs that a nonprofit would not be able to. That's changed a little bit, and it's still an ongoing and evolving issue. The other part of it is that the state of Alaska didn't want to have to deal with 200 or so individual tribes. It would much prefer to deal with one regional nonprofit. And when oil money was flush, that was sort of the stance and the operation. No, tribes don't exist here. And that's changing, of course, as the economics of our state has changed. And it's become more and more clear, certainly in my time of being involved with these things, that some of the services that the state previously provided, the tribes could do co-management of and access and tap into federal funds. Public safety is one that's pretty obvious. So instead of the state of Alaska footing the bill for the village public safety officer program, if they work with the tribes and the larger nonprofit entities, they can tap into Department of Justice funds for Indian Country for policing. And it's sort of the state then releases part of its duties, I guess, or and this is, again, this is an evolving thing, and there's concerns about, they hear the horror stories about how non-Native members are treated on Indian lands, and reverse discrimination, and on it goes. So these things just continue to evolve, and it's still not completely settled.
This also played a part in some of the CARES money too, didn't it? There was
correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that was the question, and that's where it becomes confusing and contradictory. So when the CARES money came through, there was an argument mostly by tribes in the lower 48, although there were a few Alaskan tribes, that the money that Congress had set aside for CARES Act should only go to tribal entities. What the federal government finally decided was no, that the ANCSA corporations do represent a population of Native people that are not enrolled into a tribe. And so for us to not fund it through that avenue and descendants, that it would leave a chunk of people out. Mm-hmm. So, and that's ultimately what happened. So people ask me, well, what did you think about that decision? Well, I wear a lot of different hats, or I have multiple identities, because I am obviously I'm the president of the Native Village of Aklutna, but I'm also a Siri shareholder. And I recognize that at the end of the day, with the corporations becoming successful and their recognition, that means that more money came to Alaska overall than would have had it not happened, because, you know, it would have just, and these are just hypothetical numbers, but, you know, someone like the Navajo Nation stood, if they had been successful and said that the ANCSA corporations are not to be a part of it, would have gotten an extra, say, $100 million or something like that. I mean, because they are the largest tribe in the United States. As it sits, I think they still got close to $1 billion or something. Again, don't quote me on that, but it was a very large number. So, yeah, so there's a lot of ambiguity right now about what rights do the tribes have, because the federal government on the one hand says, yes, you qualify for these various Indian grants through the Bureau of Indian Affairs, but then you don't qualify in other avenues, and it becomes very confusing, and lots of money has to get spent with lawyers to kind of separate it out. And it's evolving depending on which administration is in charge and which state administration and all those things.
So I do want to get to the part about Chugach State Park and the planning unit that you're in, but I would be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about the gaming issue, because there was an article in the paper today. So if you'd like to speak to that, go ahead.
So in 1925, the federal government created what was through an executive order called the Aklutna Educational Reserve. It was a reserve of 328,000 acres. Basically everything from the edge of Anchorage, you know, up into Muldoon, all the way up into a little bit of the Mat-Su Burrow along the Knik River and that area, as an educational reserve set aside, where they created a Bureau of Indian Affairs school. Well, and I should point out also that there were some homesteads around, you know, different pieces closer to Anchorage or up in Eagle River, but very small numbers. Well, over the decades, that 328,000 acre educational reserve got whittled down by various federal agencies. So when Elmendorf was put in and when Fort Rich was put in, it was basically one federal agency transferring it to the other. And the people of the area, you know, the Aklutna people were never consulted on these things. The roads that went in, the railroad was already there, so that was its own separate thing. So the highways, gravel, extraction, you know, all the development that occurred, you know, we were never consulted. And at the end, in the early 1960s, when the Native Village of Aklutna was first kind of officially established, what was quote unquote the educational reserve was down to about 1,000 acres around the immediate area of the village. And my great grandmother had filed for a Native allotment about 5 miles south of the village at Birchwood, where she had lived since the 1920s. And my great uncle told her to file for that allotment because he was afraid, he'd seen what had happened, that it would just be taken out from under her. And one day, you know, the land that she'd lived on for 30 years, she'd be told was no longer hers. So they went down and they filed for a Native allotment in the immediate area around her house, about 8 acres, and were granted it. And then she passed away, and then it went to her children, including my grandmother. And my great uncle had lived on the property and moved back to the property, I think, in 1985, and lived there till he passed away in 2016, 2017. So the argument that we had was that our native allotment should not be treated differently than a native allotment in the lower 48, because we have a tribe that has always been in the area and has exercised tribal jurisdiction, that in other places in the lower 48, the federal government has said that you can have off-reservation gaming on a native allotment outside of it. And so that's what our lawsuit was about. And what the federal government is claiming now is that because we did not have a quote-unquote proper treaty and reservation that had formally been established, that it then means that our native allotment is not the same as a native allotment in the lower 48, or not, I don't say not the same, it's not completely the same, or does not fit the same definitions for a gaming facility. And so, yeah, we just got our reaffirmation in court, and we're now weighing our decisions. But it's a disappointment, because it's just, again, we feel that it's an opportunity for the federal government once and for all to say that that there's a level of equity in lands that are held in trust by the Bureau of Indian Affairs on behalf of Alaska Natives should be treated the same as lands held in trust by the Bureau of Indian Affairs for Natives in the lower 48. But they're coming back and saying, no, actually it isn't, because it should be pointed out that unlike those ANCSA lands that can be bought and sold, our native allotment is locked in. It's, you know, it's held in trust. And to get it out of that would probably take us another decade, which I'm not in favor of at this point. But if we were to try to do it, we would then have to go spend a lot of money to try to get it out, because we're not afforded the same, all the same protections, I should say. We have some of them, but not all the same protections over that piece of property. So essentially what it means right now is that we're kind of in this purgatory, I guess is the best way of putting it.
That's a bummer. That is a real bummer.
Yeah. So I guess that's, I guess my message would be, I guess Indian lands in Alaska held in trust are in purgatory.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about then the Aklutna Peters Creek Planning Unit, which is part of the Chugach State Park. Mm-hmm. And I mean, your ancestors obviously held this spot near and dear. And there was a lot of activity by the indigenous people way back when in this area, hunting, fishing, like you said earlier. Mm-hmm. I think for Anchorage, for everybody in Anchorage, one of the most significant pieces of this is where most of our drinking water comes from.
Correct.
So Aklutna Lake, this huge lake, that's not just a recreational lake, but also mm-hmm. a very important source of drinking
water. Yeah, about 90% of our drinking water comes from it. And also, so in 1929, there was a hydroelectric dam that was put about halfway up the Aklutna River, built by a local business development family that created this hydroelectric dam that provided a lot of the electricity for Anchorage in those early days. But by World War II, it couldn't keep up and it wasn't generating enough. And actually during the war, they had to bring in an old World War I warship to generate electricity for Anchorage. And so after the war, it was decided, or it was, you know, it was the federal government decided that there needed to be a better solution. And so they went to the head of the lake and created a much larger, much more significant hydroelectric power plant that then provided power for the city, and essentially then cut off water from the upper half of the river from the head of the lake down to the old dam, no water would flow except in the event of occasional spillovers, which they work really hard to kind of keep the level so that it doesn't happen. But sometimes, you know, a massive rainstorm comes in or something and it would spill over. And so I think since the 1960s, there's been like every few years, one of these spillover events. But generally speaking, the river kind of went dry. And so when most people see the Eklutna River, what they don't realize is the water that they're seeing is not from the lake itself, or wasn't. It's coming from runoff from Thunderbird Creek and some of the other creeks in the area. Luckily, because of that, there has been and still continues to be a small run of salmon that are able to spawn in the lower part of the river. But that deadbeat dam impeded them from going any further up. And of course, having no water, they wouldn't have been able to go much further anyways. But nevertheless, we, for several decades, the tribe had worked on rehabbing the river. They pulled out hundreds of tons of junk cars and refrigerators and old TVs and debris that people had dumped off the cliffs there for decades to kind of rehab it. And then in a few years ago, 2017 or 2018, the actual dam was taken out with a number of partners with the tribe, and the Rasmussen Foundation contributed, the Trouts Unlimited and the Conservation Fund to take that deadbeat dam out. And in 1990, when the federal government sold its interest in different energy projects in Alaska to the state, there was a 30-year clause put into it that said that after 30 years, the utilities had to do a study of the river and the flora and fauna and see if water, you know, if sending some water down the river would help improve the habitat. Now, the utilities argument always had been with the deadbeat dam, why would we send water down the river when it's just going to hit that old dam? But once we took out the old dam, that argument went away. And so just last week, for the first time since 1929, water from the head of the lake is going down the entire length of the Eklutna River, and they're studying it, looking at the hydrology and you know, the impacts and whatnot. And our hope is that at some point there will be some regular flows that occur into the river, and what that number is still trying to be determined, kind of that sweet spot, because the utilities naturally don't want to give up all of their cheap energy that's being generated by this hydroelectric dam that goes through the mountain and then spills in on the backside of the mountain into what's called the Eklutna Tail Race on the old Glen Highway, and then goes into the Kinnick River after it's, you know, generated all of its power. And so our hope is that we can get some of that water back into the actual river to improve salmon habitat, and also just the overall effects that having more salmon in the river will have for the entire Eklutna Valley, that it'll attract more flora and fauna. It should be pointed out that I think even Chugach State Park is realizing those opportunities with its recent improvements up there, and it's, you know, the cabins and rentals and things, and the roads. When I was a kid, you know, when you went above the water plant, you know, it was all gravel. You know, now I was just on there last week, and now they've just repaved it. Wow. It's still pretty narrow, but it's in pretty good shape, and the parking lots were overflowing on a Saturday in the middle of September. So I think COVID on top of it has also, I would be interested to see and that'll probably be the next time we have a meeting with Chugach State Park. What are the demographic shifts that have occurred in the last 2 years? And I'm almost positive that it's probably doubled the number of visitors they're getting, you know, on a weekly basis. Mm-hmm. Not so much the camping, that's probably about the same, or maybe went up 20-30%, but the day use stuff is exploded, I believe. Absolutely. I think so too. Because there wasn't that long ago, I would run into people and they'd say, Clutna Lake, I've never been there, you know. And now it's like, oh my God, I didn't know this was in our backyard and things. And I think part of it also is just some of the shift in people's outdoor recreational habits with the decline and virtual shutdown of any form of you know, king salmon fishing in Upper Cook Inlet, you know, places that people used to go, say to the Deshka or Croteau Creek or Montana Creek, and those kinds of places aren't happening. You know, the growth of the Matsu Burrow, all those things kind of lead to people looking at other outdoor opportunities. And I think especially relatively close to home, I think all kind of feed into that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Aaron, this has been fantastic. I have learned so much. And I have to say, you know, I was born and raised here and went to the public school system in Anchorage. Well, I don't know if the experience was different for you, but I definitely learned about Native culture generally in Alaska, mm-hmm. but never really had an understanding of the Dena'ina.
No.
In Anchorage, there was nothing taught to us about the Dena'ina in Anchorage. So this would have been the 70s and early 80s.
A lot of the cultural practices that vanished, you know, by the time my grandmother was born in the 1930s in this area were continuing and in some cases still continue to this day with subsistence activities and cultural beliefs and those kinds of things. And so kind of uniting all of the Dena'ina villages in South Central and then doing an exhibition at the Anchorage Museum and an exhibition catalog called Dena'inok, Who Truly Is She, the Dena'ina Way of Living, kind of brought all these things to life and showed artifacts and objects and photographs to really kind of put a face to those invisible people that mm-hmm. that so many people had no idea existed.
Thanks so much for joining me today, Aaron.
Chanan, you're welcome.
That's it for today's show. Thanks to my guest, Aaron Leggett. You can find pictures and links to the Chugach State Park Management Plan, Shem Pete's Alaska, Aaron Leggett's essay, This Is My Story, Tenaina No More, and the Native Village of Aklutna at alaskapublic.org. You can also access and listen to the February 19th, 2021 episode of Outdoor Explorer, Chugach State Park. The show was produced by Eric Bork. My name is Lisa Keller, and from all of our hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.